It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
All right. Do you know the main reason I do this podcast?
Do you think?
Okay. I'll tell you.
I don't know.
I do this podcast because sometimes I want to tell a story that I'm confident nobody anywhere gives a shit about. But it's my podcast, so nobody could stop.
That's true.
Weirdly, I actually think you might find the story interesting. No one else is.
Okay.
Actually, told this story to a listener yesterday, and it was evident she was not interested, and I totally get why, but I still think it's interesting, so I'm gonna tell it. And it's about Final Fantasy 14, which, as we all know, I'm now playing. By the way, it's working a treat. I'm definitely hooked. The only downside is, in order to get the shit done, I have to get done it during the week. I'm not playing it nearly as much as I'd like to, but I am playing it a lot, so it's very cool. Anyway, so Final Fantasy, I'm going to try and make this approachable to people who don't understand video games or Final Fantasy or any of that stuff. The Final Fantasy series is a tragically named series because the original game was the particular studio's last attempt. Like, if this failed, they would probably go bankrupt. So they called it Final Fantasy. They went on to make a bajillion more games. And they're all called Final Fantasy, whatever. And they're, with a few very specific exceptions, they are all unrelated. They're all these fantasy stories, and like, this one takes place on a world named this with these heroes, and they do. And then the next one takes place on a totally different world with a totally different setup, and it's a totally different story that's unrelated. And they do this over and over and over and over and over and over again, which is why, on the rare occasions they actually want to make a sequel, like if they want to make a sequel to Final Fantasy X, they don't call it Final Fantasy X. They call it Final Fantasy X-2. Because Final Fantasy XI is a completely unrelated game. So I want to get that into perspective here. So we are talking about Final Fantasy XIV, which is one of a couple of games that they said, let's try this as an MMO. We'll still have a story, really cool story, a very Final Fantasy-esque story, because there are certain themes and details that are the same in most Final Fantasy. Like, they usually have a creature called Chocobo. They have a lot of the same animals. A lot of the items and abilities and stuff have similar names. There's a lot of thematic elements that are similar.
Okay.
Final Fantasy 14 is one of the ones they decided to do as an MMO. And they did it a long time ago. And they did it very poorly. And they did it so poorly that that game does not exist anymore. And they made another game called Final Fantasy 14, A Realm Reborn, that was a sort of a reboot or whatever, that is a much better game, that is the game that I'm playing now. Now, that's all prologue. In Final Fantasy 14, the premise is, we're in this fantasy world, and there's this particular continent in the fantasy world, and 5 years ago, some bad shit went down.
And yeah, they invented a crappy game.
Yes. No, that was longer than 5 years ago.
Oh. Okay.
In the story, this is 5 years ago, and some terrible shit went down, and there was an empire that was going to come take over, and there were all these monsters happening or whatever, and all the people in the different nations of the continent had to band together to form a great alliance. And then the empire was like, psych, we're actually going to drop a moon on you. And they're like, this is a problem. So then they had to get together and try and fix that. And then they were like, psych, the moon actually is inside, has a giant dragon that's going to fuck all of you up. And like, oh my god, And then something happened. And nobody can quite remember what. They know it involved some individual heroes who were very important and key into doing it. And what happened is things still got royally fucked up. But everybody didn't die. And nobody's exactly sure what happened. And nobody can remember these people. Even the people who like fought alongside them and were like theoretically friends with them. When they try and picture them, they just see this outline against a bright light. So they call them the Warriors of Light. And the game is set 5 years later. And you're just a random person from outside of this continent who has come here and you have adventures. And because it's an MMO and it's like instanced, even though millions of people are playing in the story, each of us is the chosen one. So like a lot of very specific things happen to me, but that's unrelated. Anyway, we really get into the stuff that happened 5 years ago. Cause like the same people are running the various nations and you get flashbacks to like the whole battle and stuff. And it's really detailed. And I thought that was interesting. And I had a theory. And so I looked it up. The game that sucked, that is over, was that story. And in fact, if you were playing in that game, you were one of these Warriors of Light that like found all these things and got the nations together. And like the end of the MMO was this giant battle that we talk about from 5 years ago and the moon came down and all that stuff. And in fact, the very end was everything failed. And so one of the NPCs used his magic to send the warriors outside of time so they could come to defend the continent another time. So I think I might be a reborn of those, but I thought it was really neat that the MMO that is defunct now, this is a direct sequel to it and like is regularly referenced and talked about. And you don't have to have known it because, you know, there's lots of fantasy stories love to have some sort of cataclysm that we're all rebuilding from. But like they have a lot of granular detail and like moments that I'm like, they really work to make this feel real. And it's like, because it actually was. It was just the earlier game. And I think that's really interesting. And I don't think anybody else does, but it's my podcast. So fuck off. Hello everyone, welcome to Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that seriously considered making this like my official outfit for the podcast, but then remembered we sometimes do this podcast when it's summer and screw that, so not gonna happen, but for now I still love it. I'm Tony
and I'm William and this is episode 569.
It appears you were not interested in that story as I thought you would be. So I apologize for getting your hopes up. But I also don't care that you weren't interested. the same as everyone who listens.
I know. I found it interesting. You know, this might be something that, you know, Abby actually plays. So we haven't talked much about it, but she might. I don't know.
It is good. And it is very story driven. Like you can't, technically speaking, you can't quite do the whole game, the whole storyline solo. There are certain like dungeons and things where you need people, but they're not, it's not complicated or anything supposedly. And the really fascinating thing for me about this game is that it's one of the common elements in Final Fantasy games is what's called the job system. And it's this idea that any given character, like your character is a fighter, but your character could totally switch jobs and become a wizard at any given time. And they would still know all their fighter stuff, but that would not be accessible because they're in wizard mode. But then if they switch back to fighter, they're still as strong a fighter as they ever were. And this has that for everything. So like I started off as what's called an arcanist, which is kind of a spellcaster. And I'm doing that and I'm going up in levels in that. And I hit like level 11 in that. And then I'm like, I want to go try some crafting stuff. So I go and I join the guild that's like cooking and they give me a thing. And it's a matter of what you equip in your main hand. And I equipped in this case, a frying pan and suddenly boom, I'm a level 1 cook. and I can only use stuff that level one cooks can use. And then I did some crafting and stuff, and then I got that level up. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to go out and kill some monsters again and stuff. So I put on, I grabbed my grimoire, and suddenly, bam, I'm on the level 11 Arcanist again. And if I want to, I can go, like, I'm a wizard kind of thing, but I could go to, like, where the fighters are and be like, I want to be a gladiator. And they'll be like, sure, here, take this, I assume, sword. And I'll take the sword, and boom, level one gladiator. And then I hear, so you can, theoretically, one character can be every single class and job in the game and do every single kind of crafting in the game with just a single character. And you can make more, like with most MMOs. I think you have the ability to make 8 characters on a given server and 40 characters overall. Wow. And I probably do want to make other ones because some of the different races are I like them. So I want to try some of them out. But you don't have to. It's kind of fun. For those of you just joining us, sorry. We have the hat. It's magical in that it has its own email address. Did you see? I fixed the about.
Did you? No, I didn't see it.
I did. I don't know why. It's not like me to do something, but I did. The hat is magical in that it has its own email address because hats don't normally have that. It's magic. TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. And people, we need more people. Come on, people. We're getting low again. But people, write into that email address, TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com, with whatever. Things that they would like us to know and then potentially say out loud, maybe even discuss. I do find it interesting that Asher Talon might sort of, but nobody has written in just to plug whatever their shit is. I'm surprising. Like Asher Talon, you should write in with an email that's just to plug Tuning Japanese, assuming that's still going on. Because if the hat likes it, we'll read it. So yeah, the hat figures out which ones it wants us to check out, and it forwards them to us, and then we read them and talk about them. About an hour. We've been running long lately, but that's what we strive for. About an hour. That's the show. What episode number is this again?
569.
Nice. All right. How's your week been?
Okay. Just a lot of school. We watched Reacher.
Reacher?
Yeah.
Oh, as in comma Jack?
Well, the show's just called Reacher, but yeah, Jack Reacher.
Yeah, yeah. No, when you just said Reacher, I was imagining a weird horror creature feature thing. And then I'm like, oh no, it's a fucking Tom Clancy deal. I mean, I don't think it is Tom Clancy, but it's that kind of deal.
Yeah.
With a dude named Jack Reacher.
It's based on books and whatever.
How was it? That doesn't strike me. I mean, I don't know a lot about it because I'm not interested, but it doesn't strike me as something y'all would be interested in.
I mean, depends, you know, because it kind of builds itself as a thriller, which,
yeah,
I'll watch.
But a political espionage kind of thriller.
Sure. But I mean,
is that a thing for you guys? I guess.
Sure. Like we like The Americans quite a bit.
Point.
I don't know why we decided to watch it because the previews didn't look very good, but the pilot was better than we expected. It turned out that the promotional material for it is pretty off for what it actually is. At least we thought so. Mm. So we watched, and we ended up watching the whole thing, and it kept our interest enough to watch the whole first season. And I felt like the fundamentals were really good. Like on paper, it definitely would have been something that we would have liked, but the execution wasn't that great. It felt like it was all based on one of the books, and it felt like a deal where there was enough stuff in the book for maybe 4 hours worth, but not 8 hours worth. And then they didn't really know how to stretch it out.
Yeah.
So you would have these moments where it's like, now that moment seems pretty cool, but now it's, you know, you're gonna plod to the next moment that's cool, whether it's an action scene that's cool or whether it's a, you know, they do a lot of, he's kind of a detective type and he does some detective-y stuff, cold reads and things like that, which some of it's pretty cliche and you kind of roll your eyes, but the rest of it's like, oh, that's pretty cool that he can do that or that character's like that. And I liked how everybody's acting was good and the characterizations were all good and all that. There's nothing wrong with that. I thought I didn't like the plot, but by the time it was over, I realized, though, the plot was actually okay. It was just
how it was meted out.
Yeah.
I really like this idea because I have a lot of these, especially when something is based on a short story. It's like, if it's based on a short story, it should probably be a short film. and they often are. But my favorite journalist entertainment journalist online. One time I was watching him in a video and he was talking, he mentioned offhand in the conversation, the Tarantino movie, The Hateful Eight. Hmm. And he's not a fan of the movie, but he actually has really thought about it. And if you just straight up cut out like 30 some odd minutes from it, he thinks it would be an incredible movie.
Well,
and not because like those are particularly harmful, but like they bloat it in just such a way that it fucks off the pacing and everything.
Yeah, I think the same might go with this show. If you cut out, well, another thing is I don't know if this is part of how they put the story together, but it didn't seem like they really nailed the thriller aesthetic or the thriller tone. Like, again, on paper, I could see how this would be a fantastic thriller, and it just never got there.
Well, a large part of that isn't about the plot. It's about how you have your people reacting. Like, it's about characterization.
Yeah,
you could have that sounds like a great thriller, but if your characters don't act in ways that would make sense or help ratchet up the tension, it wouldn't work.
Well, that's part of it. I think also maybe, I mean, the use of sound and music, the use of lighting, and things like that. I mean, my recollection of it as I'm thinking of the show, it was shot very, you know, one camera TV show kind of shooting. I mean, there didn't seem to be a lot of effort to take. I mean, the plot had thriller elements and there were scenes that were, the set piece was a thriller set piece in terms of what was there and how it was stage and everything, but the way it was actually shot with camera angles and lighting and everything else was like, you're not making very good use of what the set dressers did here. Because some of them were like gruesome, for example, like really gruesome, yeah. And like, oh, you know, horrifying, but it wasn't horrifying the way they shot it and the way the sound was done and things like that. So they never quite got it.
I don't think of myself as academic when it comes to film, and in fact I have a weird, very negative reaction to film critique in general, which is weird because I don't have the same reaction to literary critique, but something about the film critique immediately makes me think of 20 something white guys with their heads way up their own butts. And I just, so like anytime I see that kind of thing, but as I get older, I am much more conscious of the individual components. Because we all understand writing. Like the words they said were good or the words they said were bad. And to a degree, the plot was good or the plot was bad. And we're all, frankly, way too focused on the acting. Because that's what we see. And so we think, so when a movie is good, it's because of the actors in our heads or because of the director. But that's just because shorthand for all of us is the director is the boss of the movie.
Yeah.
Which is not accurate. And also directing is a thing.
Yeah.
Like specifically. And I have seen movies now that like, I liked it, but the direction was, in my opinion, bad. Or I didn't like it, but I thought it was well-directed, that kind of thing. But then also bits like director of photography, editing, sound, set design.
Yep.
Editing's such a huge one for me.
Now. Oh, yeah. That's where the story's told in the editing room.
Break a film so
That's right.
much.
That's right.
And I feel weirdly pedantic, but I get more and more about that, where less often am I like, this movie was good or this movie was bad. I'll be like, the plot of this movie was good. The direction was kind of bad. The editing was wonderful, and I think that saved it. But the design, like that kind of thing.
Yep. Yep.
And I don't know if that's an older, wiser thing or just I'm old and cranky now. Like, I don't know if other people have this experience as they get older. I think of you as a student of film to a degree. I think of you as sort of an avocation. So you kind of don't count. But you're a filmmaker, which also puts you out of the running. But I wonder for people who just watch, it may be because I do watch a lot of film critiques, which this is where we don't have enough words for different things. I like things criticizing, looking at a film through a critical eye. The school of like film critique and the, you know, do we want to go into the auteur thing and you know, subtext and all of that crap. I get really tired of. Whereas in a literary school of thought, I can do that till the cows come home, and I don't exactly know what the difference is. But I watch a lot of things that deconstruct a lot of film stuff, and so that may be. For instance, just before we started this, I was rewatching a video which openly mocks how ridiculous Luke's plan was at the beginning of Return of the Jedi, and how everything that happened made no sense and only worked by pure coincidence.
That's right.
And things like that, that I'm like, and in some ways that does mess me up now because I am sort of nitpicky, but I think it has helped me break down, like being able to point out flaws like that have helped me break down. Oh yeah. Sometimes it's bad just because of this, or it's good just because of this. And fair dues were fair dues. There are movies that I have only liked the acting in, but I've enjoyed the movie purely for the acting. So, you know.
Well, I think too, like you said, I even when I was a kid, I was watching Siskel and Ebert, and I was watching movies and documentaries on how certain things were made, which fascinated me more than the movies themselves. So this is something I've been doing my whole life. But I do notice that people, one thing that people do as they get older, so this is, I think, kind of a function of age, is they start to, as new things come out that they don't like, and it's like, well, why did you like Star Wars? And, you know, this isn't any worse than Star Wars. And so then you go, why did I like
actually, yeah.
And then you start breaking down, well, it's true, the script of Star Wars was really terrible. And it's true, this was bad, you know, but these things were good. And that's what I liked about it. And that's what I still like about it. And so the older you get, I guess what I'm trying to say is I've noticed that the older people get, the more often they have to learn to differentiate between the things they like and don't like, mostly because they don't like new things and they have to defend why they like the old things. And that makes them sort of break it down.
Defend sometimes to other people, but also like I get a lot in my case where I'm like, somebody pointed out something really terrible about this, I still kind of like it, and yeah. I can't, like, I need to think, even if I'm not going to argue with anybody, I'm like, why is that? Because I don't disagree with them, but I still like it. So then I have to be like, okay, what do I like? And yeah, it's just good anyway. Like, I mean, spoiler alert, a lot of the shit y'all like in the 80s is fucked up, misogynist and racist and all sorts of things. Yeah. Doesn't mean I don't still like them in some cases. In some cases it does. But you don't get to pretend that's not there. You just have to be like, yeah, that part sucked, but this like was good.
But see, this makes me think of something I've been thinking about lately, is how important criticism is, including certain schools of criticism, right? Because there's not just criticism. There's people who have a particular method or mode or philosophy about what is, you know, about criticism and so on and so forth. And I'm bringing this up because, you know, there's a lot of debate out in the wherever about critical theories, right?
Yeah.
And it's... it's upsetting because, okay, let's say somebody took Darwin's theory of evolution and used it to make really racist arguments.
Let's say hypothetically,
hypothetically,
that could possibly have ever happened.
It should be very easy to imagine. You would criticize this person for being a racist. You wouldn't throw away Darwin's theory of evolution, right? You wouldn't.
I mean, I would, but I would know I shouldn't. I'd be doing it just to be a little stinker.
You hear what I'm saying? You don't. The theory of evolution isn't at fault here. It's this idiot for taking it and applying it in a way that doesn't even make sense if you really understand the theory of evolution. Criticism or literary criticism, film criticism, or modes or philosophies, or they sort of misname them theories, right, of criticism are getting thrown out with the bathwater, so to speak, because some people are misusing them and some people are criticizing them in a way that doesn't really make sense. The thing is, there's nothing wrong with, as far as I can tell, there's nothing wrong with various modes of criticism, including criticism that uses that looks through the lens of power. Mm-hmm. I mean, and even if it expressly borrows from Marx, but it doesn't have to. There's a lot of different philosophies of criticism that are based around power that do not refer to Marx. These things are tools. They're just tools that people use to analyze certain things. And it's okay for people to disagree with what they say or their conclusions or whatever. That's not the point. The point is, if you find someone who you think is misusing it, maybe they are, maybe they aren't, to attack the whole method or the whole idea of criticizing things or having a philosophical backdrop or lens through which you do so, that's just ridiculous. I mean,
it's fucking everywhere. I mean, maybe it wasn't on purpose, but all I could think about when you're talking is the whole CRT debate. But really don't want to get into that right now. But I mean, there's the concept that, like, in the past, there have been socialist leaders that were bad. So a lot of people now think socialism is terrible because of that. And that's not the same thing. And you get a lot of people, organized religion has done terrible things, many varieties. And a lot of people then think that religion is just awful in and of itself. It's like, no, that's not. And I think you get this in a lot of places. Now, we do need to make the caveat here. And I think this is important because this is where film critique often pisses me off and everything. If it's an entertainment situation, as with many films it is, and you personally are like, a couple things. You could be like, you're right about all that stuff, and that's very bad. I still enjoy it. Or if you're one of those people who's like, I don't want to think about that. I just like watching when the things blow up or whatever. Sorry, that intentionally was backhandedly insulting my hypothetical person, and I don't mean to do that. That's fine. This level of criticism is good for the industry of filmmaking and good for society as a whole. It is not a necessity, and it doesn't mean you aren't watching the film right.
No, that's exactly right. And see, that's a thing.
And it's very easy to get caught up in.
No, that's true. But when I was in college, I mean, some of the first classes I took had literary criticism because I was a religion major at first, and we studied biblical literature, and sometimes certain modes and philosophies of criticism were used and applied to the text. And it was very clear to me while I was in college learning this stuff that this was just one way to look at it that's useful to draw some conclusions and to think about literature in a particular way, to think about history in a particular way. It wasn't really passing a judgment. Like, when it was over, it wasn't like, okay, so no one should read this, or everyone should read this, or this is what everyone should think about this. It was never like that. It was just a tool you were using mostly for the purposes of the class or a paper you were going to write. And that's it. Yes.
However,
I was going to point out the most recent version of this that I can remember in popular culture. It's kind of outdated now, but Anita Sarkeesian, I want to say, the gal that made the stuff about games, video games, she even made it very explicit in all of her videos. She said, just because we can apply this criticism to these things doesn't mean they're bad, doesn't mean they should go away, doesn't mean you can't enjoy them. It's just helpful and meaningful for you to think about these things. But it, of course, a lot of her critics completely ignored when she would point that out.
It's the I don't have a racist bone in my body thing. It's that all over again. It's very much that argument. There can't be anything even potentially wrong with something I like, because that means it's bad and I'm bad. Therefore, that's not true. But I want to back up here.
Okay, sorry.
I'm an individual. You're an individual. There are an infinite number of possible circumstances. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, not only was the experience you had being introduced to literary criticism not mine, I feel like what I'm about to say might be more universally experienced when you go to college and deal with literary criticism. Because that was definitely not mine. What you describe, as per usual, is that of a very thoughtful, mature, open-minded, wise person, which is 100% not what I was as a freshman in college.
Well, but I mean, I felt like the professor, I mean, I took several classes like this, and all of the professors, I thought, had that kind of attitude that I'm talking
about. Agreed. So. Professors, being much older, having thought about this stuff a lot more, arguably being more mature, very much not being like a freshman in college.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
So my introduction, and I can say largely the introduction of the class I was in, which was an intro level literature course.
Okay.
My very first semester. Our general reaction at the start of the semester as this began was a whole bunch of, really? I feel like that's pushing it. Oh, come on. That's not what that's about. You're making that up. Like you're bringing shit to this. That's not what this said at all. And then at different points within the semester, each of us would have a, and by the end, we're all like, when he was talking about the hills, that there's a very like sensual topographic thing, right? As though, and we got, and I will also say this, certain pieces of literature, and in particular, because my aha moment happened, and I've talked about this before, while we were studying the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, that poem, that was where I broke. And that poem became 1,000 times better to me once I was suddenly seeing it through this lens of meta discussion and subtext and things like that.
Sure.
And it was huge for me. And I haven't gone on to do that. And to be fair, this is also true in most social sciences. When I started my gender things, it was the same thing. It's like, come on, that's not, you're making, and then by the end, I was like, oh my God. And did you notice like in that shot, the camera's like that? You know what that's saying? And so but it's very tricky because we're all very opposed before then. And it's, some of it is that I don't have a racist bone in my body. Some of it is, you know, no, if you're being critical, critical means you think it's bad. That means it's bad. And I like it. That means I'm bad. But there's also the, wow, that is subtle and nuanced. And I didn't think of it. And I still don't really get it. And so that makes me feel dumb. So instead, I'm going to say, no, you're making that up. Because otherwise, I feel like I'm dumber than you for not seeing it that way.
So I guess there are benefits to
anticipate.
I guess there are benefits to me always feeling already dumb and bad. Because if something makes me feel dumb and bad, I'm like, yeah, seems legit.
And I think you also have this, I don't know how to put this exactly, but if it comes from outside me, it's fine. Like, if other people came up with it, I can't condemn it, whatever it is. Because if it sounds horrible to me, I'm probably just not getting it in the right angle because it wasn't me. So, like, clearly it has merit. It always has merit to you.
Yeah, pretty much.
And well, so it's a matter of I need to get my context right until I can see the value of this. And it never occurs to you like the fucker who came up with that is a fucking idiot.
It's interesting that we're talking about this because the first class I took in college was rhetoric. And the book, the main book that that our rhetoric teacher had us read was called A Choice of Heroes. And it was largely about was masculinity in the United States and how certain ideas of masculinity were portrayed through the media before Vietnam. And, you know, how that contributed to the attitudes of men going who were drafted or who were joining up to go to war and so on and so forth. And this, so right out of the gate, one of the first classes I had was about gender and politics and all this stuff. And, you know, I was joking a little bit before. The fact of the matter is I don't recall during any of these criticism things ever feeling wrong or bad, even though it was new information to me.
Yeah.
I didn't know it, but I don't know. I didn't feel like there was that I'd done anything wrong by not knowing this stuff because, yeah. You know, anyhow, so I'm learning this stuff and I'm thinking, oh yeah, this makes sense. But all that stuff you were just saying, all those responses you were just saying that you were giving, all of the other kids in the class were doing that, all of them. And so I would, as you know, I'm prone to do, this has been 35 years, but it's the same thing. I was like, oh, but wait a minute, you're being very dismissive of this, but don't you think this, or don't you think that, or whatever. And eventually the rhetoric professor took me aside and he said, you know, that thing that you're doing where you're kind of trying to engage everybody when they're so dismissive of this material. And I said, yeah, I'm sorry.
He was like, stop it.
No, he said, please don't get discouraged about how people respond. And please keep doing that because if I was the one doing it, they would totally, I mean, I know you think they're rejecting you and they were, but they would be completely rejecting if I was saying it. So I know it's hard for you, and I can see that you want to just stop. Because I don't like to annoy people.
Yeah,
I was definitely on the verge of saying, you know what, I'm not going to bother these people with these thoughts. They don't want to talk about it, so we won't talk about it. So he took me aside one day and he said, "Don't quit. You know, keep. If you want to ask a question, or if you're curious, or if you want to gauge, if you don't want to, don't." He said, you know, he didn't want me to do something I didn't want to do, but if you feel like doing it, don't stop yourself because you're afraid of offending someone or whatever. Please ask, because I think what you're doing is important. And if you don't do it, I'll have to do it. And it'll be absolutely ineffective if I do it.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah. And it's not wrong. And this is the thing. And this is why those of us who know and love you tell you you're the odd person out. You're the weird one. But your outlook is really good and the rest of us wish we had it, which is something I know you hear a lot because I say it a lot and I've seen other people say it to you. And this is where it comes from. And here's the thing. And we all like to think we're not one of these, and maybe the rest of you aren't. I don't know. But in my experience, William is in a position. Well, I'm in a position, as much as I know consciously it's not true, but my subconscious is everyone sucks except me. Which is to say, if you do things like me, you don't suck. But my thing doesn't suck. All other things suck. And that's a bad attitude to have. William, I believe you have an attitude that nobody sucks except me.
For the most part.
That one's more specific because I seriously doubt you're like, hey, that person's acting like me. They also suck. I don't. Like, no, you're nobody sucks but you. And that's also not good.
No, it isn't.
But there are two things I will say to this. One, I think my attitude is more common. Oh, I don't know that for sure, but I think that's true. You are an extreme version of the other one, so maybe not. But the other thing is, neither of those is a good attitude to have. Right. But the thing about your attitude is it respects and gives validity and fairness to every single human in existence, except yourself, which means from a percentages game, it's a great outlook to have.
Percentages game.
It means that with the exception of one person, you look on everyone fairly and with respect and with an open mind. And ideally, it would be every person. But in my case, it's I only seem to do it with the people who think the way I do. Whereas in your case, you do it with everyone except this one guy who you really don't like. You are the city of Omelas. You are the fucking city of Omelas, and you are the child in the room in the dark. You have a great... those who walk away from Omelas, it's a perfect city where everybody is open and everybody respects everybody and everybody has enough and it's wonderful, but it is predicated on one child in the dark somewhere who is suffering. You remember this, right? We have discussed this at length.
And those who walk familiar. Away from
Omelas, the Ursula Le Guin story.
Yeah, yeah. You talked.
It is about a perfect city that is perfect because of the suffering of one person locked away in the dark somewhere, and everybody knows about it. And the whole thing is a thought experiment of, are you a person who would help that person suffering, knowing it would destroy the city? Are you a person who will just live in the city and live with the guilt of knowing that? Or are you a person who will leave the entire situation and say, I'm not going to stop how you're doing it, but I can't participate. And that's sort of the thought experiment. And I just had the realization that you within yourself are that city, and you have an open and caring and respectful view of all of mankind, except for one person in the dark who must suffer for that, and is you.
Wow, that's interesting. And very weird.
It is. It is. I think I've blown my own mind with this. And I mean that both in the sense that I have given myself a genuine sense of awe at the realization, and that this entire thought process is probably masturbatory. But yeah.
Aren't most of our thought processes that? I think.
I mean, mine definitely. I at gaming earlier in the week. So I'm running the game with people, and the game I currently have is it's at a fantasy world, and all the characters are members of essentially a traveling circus. And so we're going place to place and having adventures as we're performing. So the thing we're currently doing. In the last town, a married couple and their small child joined the circus, not to perform, but they're going to like work as laborers and help keep things organized or whatever. And in the most recent one of the players was essentially babysitting the kid during a evening bonfire thing. And then the kid is missing.
Oh, no.
And they're trying to find the kid. So in the midst of this, in real life, one of the players had to excuse themselves for a moment, for a few minutes. And it was in a situation where, like, they were central. So I'm like, we have to wait for them to come back before we can keep going. And so we're just sort of shooting the shit a little bit. And I make this joke about, like, explaining to the child's parents that we're giving up on looking for her. We're pretty sure she's dead. And I start doing this whole riff of, like, if it's any consolation to you, like, based on our history, statistically speaking, your child was absolutely going to be dead within the next week. Like, this circus is not good for children.
Okay.
Like, come into a lot of situations. So it's kind of amazing she made it. And I just kept going by myself in this whole thing. And I was like, one time crows took one of our, like, I'm not even like regular crows. And this kid was like 11. This was not a small kid. I have never seen crows work together like that. Like, they all just grabbed different, I just flew away. And I went for like 4 or 5 minutes and nobody, like everybody else just doing, but I'm like, it's cracking me up. So it's fine. And I'm like, what else are we going to do? Sit in polite silence till she comes back? Like, but yeah, that whole thing, I'm like, that was a hilarious 4-minute set by me, for me, for an audience of one.
Oh, that's a, I mean, that's fair.
I don't remember what it was. Somebody was kind of putting in things, and then she said something that cracked me up enough that I'm like, yeah, you ruined my bit. I can't go on because you made me laugh. I think they did point out a murder of crows was part of it too. I'm trying to jump back to, like, because we're like four tangents in now, and I'm like, where did we start? Was this you telling me about your week?
Yeah, because I was talking about Reacher and I was criticizing certain aspects of it. Then we started pieces, and then I talking about criticism.
Okay. So you got anything else in your week?
No. We're almost done.
We're clearly not going to get into this.
But what about your week?
Not bad. Gaming went well. Therapy went well. So here's a fun one. Not this week's session, the previous week's session. I've been thinking about it, and I think I was a little mean to my therapist.
Oh.
And specifically, I was sort of mean in the way I have a thing with, one of the things I'm working on with my therapist is how I treat a lot of my friends. And I treat them in ways that I think is kind of mean. It's sort of disrespectful. And I don't, It grows out of a tease. You can probably see this. It grows out of a teasing thing, but I'm like a little too harsh about it. And I can hurt people's feelings and I feel like a jerk afterwards and stuff like that. And I was like, I feel like I'm kind of treating my therapist. I'm doing a lot of joking with her and stuff and sort of like comedic references to issues I have with her and stuff. And afterwards I was like, she's not going to care. She's my therapist. She's literally paid to listen to me talk about shit. So whatever. But I'm like, but it matters to me. And it's not, first of all, it is very incumbent upon me personally that I see the therapy as a relationship.
Sure.
I couldn't do this with something that didn't, like, there's a connection. And it may be a professional one and we will never be friends and that kind of thing. But, like, it's still a relationship. She's still a human being. I need to treat her as such. And even more specifically, it's not great if I'm getting better in how I treat my friends because I'm just shunting all of that bad habit into my therapist.
Right.
That's so, like, for me, this is bad and I should bring it up. It's something I should work on, even though she won't care because she's like, money spends all the same. I get paid either way. But so then we start the session. We did it on Zoom because I had the sniffles on Monday and I was a little worried. Not that I had COVID, but I'm just like, I don't want to, and Zoom works fine. So I emailed and been like, let's do it on Zoom. So we do it and we have the intern there, whatever. And I was like, yeah, I got a couple things I want to talk about this week. And she's like, before we do that, I got something I want to reach back to last week. We were discussing it and I've been thinking about it and I didn't sort of notice at the time, but in retrospect, I kind of feel attacked from the way our conversation went near the end of the last session, which to certain people are like, why the fuck would the therapist ever say that? And I would agree in a lot of contexts, what are you doing? But she gets me now. And also I got to say, I'm like, I'm really glad you said that. I've genuinely been thinking the same thing all week. Let's talk about it. And we did. And really good stuff came out of that. But it also is a weird validation for me. It's like, clearly I was onto something if independently my therapist was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think it was really good. Be prepared. This is going to be a shock to you. I have a tendency to deflect serious situations with humor.
Mm-hmm.
Can you believe such a thing?
Oh, sorry. What?
You're right, right?
No, come on. That's ridiculous.
And full disclosure, I fucking know it. I know this is a thing. But the depth to which it is a thing is something I am just learning now. In my head, I'm very much like, yeah, I goof around or whatever. But when, like, we need to be serious, we can be serious.
Yeah.
And that is true for approximately two sentences. And then I have to make a joke, even if we're still talking. Like, even if it's not one that derails, like, I have to sneak one in. To the degree that when I had this realization and was talking to my therapists, about it, I still snuck in a joke there occasionally, like while explaining this problem I have. And I think some of it is, I have a lot of my identity tied up in being a smart person. I think I have way more of my identity tied up in being a funny person. I think a lot of me is like, if I'm not funny, I'm not sure what I am. And of course, the real obvious one now is sometimes I say things that are a bad thing to say and will be hurtful or will at least not be helpful or will like cause complications. But I have to say them because in my head, I'm like, it's funny. And if it's funny, I'm going to say it. And that's not healthy. But there's a little bit of irony. I came to therapy because I'm like, my life's pretty good. But I'm unhappy a lot. And what we're dealing with in therapy is a lot more of like, how can I be the kind of person I want to be? Which in the grand scheme, that will probably help me be happier. But it's really not addressing the actual thing. And I'm very happy with my therapy, but it has not escaped me that I'm like, we're really doing some shit that is not the reason I showed up here. But, you know, I absolutely get off on self-knowledge. So this has been interesting. But there's been a lot of, I feel like in my head, I can't be that shocked anymore. Like I learn new things about myself, but seldom do I learn things that like alter my fundamental perspective. And I'd say I've had about three of those in the last couple of months.
Well, and that's good, I think.
I am learning. It is. I'm very pleased with it. But it's very surprising. We have watched
I was just gonna say I kind of hope that my therapy experience is similar because I think I could use some insight.
I mean I wasn't gonna talk about this on the podcast in case you didn't want to, but I think there's a big thing. I had a piece of advice that I was gonna give you after re-recording of this. This is again one I think you know, but it's probably good to be reinforced. You have a very strong sense of privacy and proprietary boundaries.
Yeah.
You need to try just the absolute hardest you can to literally eradicate those with your therapist. I mean, and I'm going to say, and I genuinely believe this, you cannot be too open with your therapist, with the possible exception of telling your therapist things about how you feel about them personally. There are lines there. And I say that as somebody who tells my therapist a lot what I think about her personally, but there are lines there. But when it comes to talking about yourself and not related to the therapist, I genuinely think you need to treat it as though you cannot be too open, because that is the whole point. And that's, therapy is supposed to be a safe space where you can do that, and then you're able to maintain whatever boundaries you're comfortable with outside of that.
Well, right.
And I think that's going to be the hard part for you.
I don't know what the hard part's going to be. That's going to be a hard part for sure. I've anticipated that already.
I guess we didn't tell
people that I have scheduled an appointment for myself in therapy. That's something that.
And I'm very proud of William about that. And after a long conversation, he understands why I am proud. And he is also proud of me for me going to therapy, right, which is fair. We should tell the rest, for those of you in it, because some of you are like, you know, I should be going to therapist, or some of you are like, people say I should be going to therapist, but I don't think so. First of all, everybody can use therapy. Nobody couldn't. As long as you got a good therapist, it can't hurt as long as you have a good therapist who won't make it hurt. A bad therapist can cause you damage. But as long as you don't got a bad one, and it has to be real bad, it'd be good. But secondly, there are some major obstacles. The point of saying I should probably get therapy, the point of saying I need to call a therapist and make an appointment, and the point of calling a therapist and making appointments, there are these very huge obstacles between all of those. And I'm sure it's different for everybody, but like the in theory, that could be a single day. You're like, maybe I should get therapy. And you think about it and you're like, yeah, let's do it. And then you call somebody and make an appointment. That's never how it is. I was like, I'd say I spent about 2 years thinking maybe I should get therapy. And then I finally decided I really needed it. And I still spent probably about 4 months. And then I had a very pointed conversation with a friend over dinner. And even then, it was a few days after that that I finally made the phone call. So that is hard. And if you get that far, you should be proud. Because a lot of people make it to one point, but not the others, or make it to the second point, but not the third. Like, there's a thing you have to break through with each one.
I think one thing that people sort of need to get over in their heads, I think some people think of mental health or seeing a mental health professional almost like seeing someone who is a specialist in overall health. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, I don't need to see a cardiologist. I don't have heart trouble, or I don't need to see a renal specialist because I don't have kidney problems. Don't think of mental health like that. Think of it more like this is a completely separate modality of your health. And if you think it's important to see a GP every year just to get a checkup, you should probably see a therapist at least once. And either you'll figure out there's something that you need to start to work on and you'll continue to see them, or you'll realize I probably need to check in with this person every 6 months or every year or something just for a mental checkup, because it's a thing that while you're tending to your physical health will not get addressed.
Yeah.
Right. Cause I mean, it's not like someone will discover you have a heart murmur and send you to a cardiologist. Someone will discover that you have a problem with your kidneys and send you to a renal expert, but it's not likely your GP, unless you complain fairly incessantly. And I'm saying this from experience, y'all, because when I was in the hospital, I asked for mental health assistance on a number of occasions and did not get it. And I'm not criticizing them or anything. I'm just telling
you. No, it's industry standard.
The people who are attending to your physical needs are not likely to notice or do enough about whatever your mental issues are. You're going to have to address that as a completely separate modality of your health. And if you think it's important to go to a GP, then you should see a therapist at least once and either continue that treatment because you've discovered you need it, or have some kind of schedule where you're going to go in every 6 months or every year to get a little bit of a mental checkup, because that's the only way your mental health is going to be checked. And if your physical health needs checked every year, your mental health definitely does. But
also, if you go to a therapist and it doesn't work for you, it doesn't necessarily mean you don't need therapy.
That's right.
It may mean that's not a good therapist, or that's not a therapist for you. There are so many different methods of taking it. And I, through bitter fucking personal experience, have discovered certain types of therapy I need. And that's why I am consequently in a situation where I'm fairly uncomfortable during my therapy sessions. I do not look forward to them, but I cannot deny that I feel better after them and that they are doing a lot of good for me. And I could definitely find therapists that I would like a lot better and get along with and whatever. We wouldn't be doing what we do, because I can talk my way around a lot of shit. So I need somebody who, for whatever reason, is going to get past that. In this case, I think she and I are so different that she's just coming. I don't think she's trying to sort of circumvent my bullshit. I think she's just coming from such a different perspective that she's like, that doesn't make sense. And I'm like, you're right, it doesn't. I don't know
what I was thinking. You're making a very good point. You should, a lot of times, finding the right therapist is trickier, I think, than finding the right doctor. And I mean, finding the right general practitioner is also tricky, and everybody knows that, but they seem not to
more. The society has vested a lot more interest in figuring that out. We're still not working on our mental health very well. We're getting better, but we're not working very well.
Yeah, but that's an amazing thing is, and I didn't think I could learn any more about how far behind we are in thinking about mental health until I started taking classes and realized, oh my gosh, we're so much further behind on this than I even thought. And it's too bad, because that means a lot of people are suffering in silence or suffering and don't even realize they're suffering, if that makes any sense. Like, they think it's normal what they're going through. And it's normal in the sense of of people go through
common things. Common yeah, but not common. Necessarily
yeah, yeah right, but it's something they don't have to continue to go through.
I think there's a school of thought also that I've been encountering a lot, which is people who are cool with therapy, and they're like, therapy's great, therapy's very important, a lot of people need therapy for one of three or four common reasons. I don't think it would really work for me. I am too smart. I am too private a person. Or the opposite. I have plenty of friends that will let me talk to them. Or the fourth one is usually, I have a specific idea of what therapy is in my head, and I do not think that thing would work for me. And to all of this, I say, get over your fucking self. You're just wrong. Like, I will pay you $1,000 if you can prove to me that you are one of the 1 in 8 bajillion people who somehow all versions of therapy have no useful impact.
Yeah.
And I'm being very generous by thinking that one person exists. Like,
I mean,
we are in our infancy compared to other sciences, but mental health professionalism has been around a long time and is a very robust and diverse field.
It very much is.
Therapists have encountered people like you, whoever you are, before.
Yeah, that's probably true. Now, it's not to say, I mean, every profession has some bad apples or whatever, and it's unfortunate if you're a person who's run into them, but please understand, that's not the rule. The rule that, in my experience, even before I started taking classes, is like Tony just pointed out, they have met someone like you before. Because that was one of my things back in the day, was I just know this person's going to have an agenda that doesn't fit into my worldview. And so I'm just, you know, they're not going to be helping me. They're going to try to be making me like they think I should be. And there are therapists. If you look, you will find a therapist out there like that. But not how therapists are,
whatever,
as a rule.
Whatever
all.
Shitty version of therapist you are, there is one of those, at least.
Probably.
But not most.
No. I mean, the profession attracts the kind of, my observation anyway, the profession tends to attract the kind of person who doesn't want to be like that.
Yes.
And sometimes goes through a lot of their own therapy so that they won't be.
Yes.
So,
and that's a lot of, I have run into several people who are, because of my particular educational or professional background, I feel like I get therapy and I know how they do it, so it wouldn't work on me.
That's good.
And that's not true to the degree that some of the people often in the most need of therapy are therapists.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
It's ridiculous.
You know, in fact, so that's
these straw men I've created suck, and you need to stop it and just call a therapist, straw men. Stop fucking around.
I mean, that's one of the reasons, you know, I need therapy anyway, but probably one of the things that's kind of helped me get over the hump is that I am taking these classes, and I think it's important for someone who's going to be a therapist to do therapy. In fact, I just talked to my academic advisor, and she said this, the program she was in, it was required for the people to take therapy. And she wished that my school did it. And I had to agree with her. I said, yeah, I wish they did too, but it doesn't matter because I'm doing it anyway. So
I don't know. It's popping in my head again. It's my podcast. I do what I want, and this will make you feel weird, but I want to talk for a second about the BDSM community.
Okay.
Specifically the concept of dominance and submission.
Okay.
It's a thing in the kink community, and there are people who like to take the role of dominant, and they are in control of a situation, and they are in charge, and people who like to take the role of submissive, and they are taken care of, or they are made to do whatever it is. It's a kinky thing, whatever. And there's a lot tied into it. There's a contract related there, and a lot of, in my experiences in the BDSM community at a young age, I found that there were a lot of people, usually guys, who thought being a dominant just meant, oh yeah, you just get your way. And it's like, no, you actually are the one with the most responsibility because you have to take care of the other one. This is the thing. And there are plenty of people who are what we call switches, who can sort of take on both. But there are definitely people out there who are like of a dominant mindset when it comes to this, or of a submissive, and they do not want to, should not, would feel very weird about taking on the other role. However, insofar as there is a tradition of people passing down the knowledge of these community practices, and there is, I have known many dominants who, in helping to teach someone who wanted to learn to be a good dominant, that they were required to engage in some scenes in a submissive role, even though that mindset and what one would get out of that is not a thing, purely because they need to know what it's like. So when they are in the position, they know what experience they are giving to the submissive.
That's interesting.
And I think this is the same thing. If in some weird world you had no issues you needed to deal with in therapy, and once again, that person doesn't fucking exist, but if somehow that was, it should still be mandatory that you, being trained as a therapist, at some point have therapy, just so you know, when I'm saying these things to this person, I know what it's like because I've been in this chair and had the person saying these things.
Yes, yes, you're right.
Even if you are getting no mental health benefit, which you are, that's bullshit. But even if for some reason you weren't, just so you know what the person who has hired you is going through when you do the shit you were hired for.
Yeah.
Very, very important.
Yeah.
So, agreed. So therapists, agreed, especially, but also we're all fucked up and we need some help. And as William has said, and I used to kind of roll my eyes, but I'm with it now. Our society nowadays is kind of built in a way that forces mental illness on all of us to varying degrees, but it's there. We got a fucked up, contradictory, irrational society going.
We do.
I think it's a scam by the therapy community to keep making that money. But honestly, my belief in that conspiracy is one of the things I'm working through with my therapist.
Good.
We should wrap it up. We're over time. I do want to say we finished Archive 81. I have issues with it, but I think I am making perfect the enemy of the good, because when I, there's a lot of things that annoy me, but when I step back, I'm like, it's still probably one of the best TV shows I've seen in a while. And I'm very glad I saw it, and I feel okay with the resolution. And I think the things that bug me are like other things were so good that I'm getting nitpicky.
Yes,
or,
I know what that.
Or also just like that there's a lot of crap TV out there these days, and so comparatively. But I would, in general, I'm going around recommending it. Okay. It's sort of horror, but it's the kind without gore. It's the kind with no more violence than you get in any other sort of drama show. It's a lot of mystery, thriller, spooky. What's going on? Is it Satan, Illuminati? All of that jazz. I enjoyed it. They very clearly set up so they can have more seasons, but I felt resolved enough. If I never see any more, I feel like the story resolved in a way that I'm comfortable with. So check that out. I'd like to say that this is the sort of protest we're doing, is that we have few enough questions or few enough emails that we're not going to do them until we have more. That's not the case. We just talked about what we want to talk about. And there, but you still should send in more. themagicaltalkinghead@gmail.com. Also, go to the blog and tell us if our frankly ongoing obsession with just discussing mental health is alienating what little audience we have left, or if is our new kicker that's gonna send us to the big time. Because I can't tell which it is. I feel like it's one of those. So let us know. Go to themagicaltalkinghead.com and tell us, because we're going hard on the mental health thing. And I don't think it's for podcast reasons. I think it's because we're both just so broken. Anyway, we love all of you, and we want all of you to get therapy. I mean, this episode's a mess, but I had a good time. And everybody watch Archive 81 and play Final Fantasy 14 and buy my book on Smashwords. It's called Odd Wings. It's pretty cheap. Buy it, read it, tell other people to read it, pretend you liked it even if you didn't, and get enough fiber every day. It's important.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.